happening a lot. We've got a bunch of people coming in the last minute.
That's cool.
Because we have, I said next year we got to put a sign up on what way that this is where the theater is, because people will wander all the way around.
It's better than last year.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I think we were tucked away in the back end of, I think a lot of people struggled to find.
And a lot of people, yeah, it's funny, if like the first day and you've been over the bridge like 9 times, you don't want to walk over the bridge anymore.
No. It's fine. Felt a bit like the gangplank, but yeah.
Well, let me start you off. Good afternoon. I'm Mike Duff, representing the IHA and Homepage News, and I'm here to introduce you to the seminar, Restaurant Delivery, Grocery Shopping, and the Future of Home Cooking. Annette Nickstein, Senior Industry Manager, Euromoto International, and Catalina Flores, Senior Analyst, Home Technology for Euromonitor, focused on the United States and Canada, will each provide a perspective on the evolution of eating. Nick will focus on the picture pressures that have battered and stressed people so much battered business model so much since 2020, not to relieve the pain, but to share pragmatic benchmarks, putting personal experiences in the context. Catalina will showcase consumer behavior from U.S. housewares sector, tracking how preferences have changed over the past several years as regards cooking habits, shopping behavior, and consumer motivations, and what they mean for the industry. So, please, Nick.
Super, thank you. Thanks for that introduction, Mike. Appreciate it. So, it's a talk about restaurant delivery and grocery trends, but it's really about how those things are then knocking on into behavior in the home and how it's affecting cooking behavior. So, if we think about this, this is across all of the data we can see at Euromonitor. So, first of all, who are we? There we go. So a little bit about us. My name's Nick. I'm about 50 years old. I'm the global head of Home and Garden. I've been around home products for about 30 years now, 20 of that brand side, the last 10 in research, consulting, teaching others to do strategy, helping to fix broken strategy, particularly because of smart home. There's a lot of things going on in that space. I'm joined by Catalina, and she's the US analyst and heads up the content and the research for US data. She's also on the global team because of how good she is on homewares. So this is, I'm leaning on Catalina a lot when I go into the global control. Catalina can do a better introduction of herself when she stands up to do her section. We're a data provider. We're generally describing ourselves as growth experts. It's because that's what we do 95% of the time. We've got a range of syndicate structures, which is like a one-size-fits-all with hundreds of clients per industry set inside of that. And then we go all the way up to fully consulting. And within Home and Garden, which is my industry, we're actually more towards consulting than we are towards the syndicated, just because of how specific this all is and how much detail you get into. Home and Garden's 1.2 trillion in global consumer spend. We break it into 70 odd categories, so we've got detail for sizes, for shares, for channels, etc. But this gives you a general overview. That's the sort of thing we're doing. I'm coming at this, Catalina's coming at this from Home and Garden, but to put this together, we've called on the entire expert network inside of the system. So we're bringing in data from across the industries, and how are they then knocking on into the home? And particularly the economies and consumers database, this is one of the most widely used in the world. It's inside of so many consulting companies, not just ours, but many of the consulting organizations use this in their planning for IPOs, for mergers and acquisitions. We had 1.7 billion views and downloads of our data across the entire system in 12 months. I looked that up yesterday. So it, just to give you an idea of scale, that economies data particularly gets a lot of use. Where might you come across us? One of the most common ways is if you look at branding inside of the store, on packaging, on brand websites, we do a claim accreditation for number one. And there's a number of places, a number of brands that are involved in it. It's one of the most common ways you might come across our name. I'm going to use this chart structure quite a lot. Catalina's got some as well. Before I confuse and lose everybody, I'm going to give a quick crash course in how to read it. So if we look at the structure, we've got the performance year on year. So the short-term demand performance is on the left-hand side, the y-axis. The longer-term demand from pandemic is across the bottom. Both of them are in current terms, so the price change is baked in. And what we've also done is make the axes cross at where inflation's sitting. So effectively, we get to see real changes in demand patterns, transaction levels, volume levels, beyond what's just happening inside of price movement. And that creates something of a Boston box, and we get into which quadrant does a product area, does a spend level sit inside of. So you'll see this format quite a lot. If I jump into the overall theme, why talk about restaurants and grocery to actually educate around cooking? It's to do with the interconnectedness of all of this. It's not individualized island spending. They're all connected. They're all actually a choice as to where someone's spending their money. What activity are they choosing to do? Where are they choosing to do it? So before I get into the overall model, I'm going to start from a macro element and just put into context one of the biggest things that's driving the behaviors and the thinking. So this is from the Economies database, and we start off with the disposable income. And we can see for each region, there has been, since the start of this crisis, a quite significant growth in wages. But naturally, the obvious conclusion, just looking at essentials, this is things like housing, it's energy, it's medical bills, and it's food. It hasn't kept up. And so we've got a drop in discretionary spend because essentials are eating more of our income. And we can feel that in our budgets. So what we see immediately is a drop over the years inside of discretionary spend, even with that increase in wages. And how does that then get manifest? Well, what's left in discretionary spend then gets subjected to a reduced buying power because of inflation across the rest of the economy. So what we really then feel is this perceived change in discretionary spending power, but that's actually as well, that's the experience to our standard of living that people are actually feeling on a day-to-day basis. You'll notice in North America, it's not the worst picture. There are some parts of the world where it's not about discretionary choices. Essentials have been completely compromised. There are parts of the North America economy where that's true too, where we're into this heat or eat horrible dilemma, but it's actually extreme in some parts of the world. Getting into what the knock-on effects from that are, we know around discounting, we know about value hunting, we know what people are going as behaviors, but how is it manifesting? If we try and do our usual trick of thinking just about our silo, just about the thing we're focused on, we can miss what's actually going on and what's the actual knock-on effect. So what we're getting into, and this is a theme that's coming up a lot in client conversations, is this idea of the context of consumption. There's lots of these models growing. This one's food, but there's ones for DIY, there's ones for fabric. All of the domestic elements around the home have these systems that grow up. So if we think about a system, it always starts from the wheel of the process. And then we overlay and we bring in all of the stakeholders, all of the disruptions, the things that have made it better, the things that have tried to make it better and made it worse, all of the things that are going on inside of the technology side and who's got a role to play inside of it. So one of the things we're noticing is ideation particularly is affected by this type of tool. And inside of the biggest disruptions that have happened in the markets, all markets, over the last 10 years, at the heart of the strategic documents that are in the origin of it, something like this has actually started to appear. Google do things like this. We've got Amazon doing things like this. Hire within the appliances space are all over this. So it's a tool that's growing in use. It's part of that change in perception, and the biggest role it's playing is challenging right to play. Do we take it as an assumption? Do we assume we can do things, or do we test it? And the act of seeing this causes people to test far more. And they don't just assume that that's a brick wall. One of the things the Koreans, when I was working for Samsung, taught me was so many of our structures in this part of the world are so solid, we take all structures for granted. And they test everything. It's one of the reasons why the Asian brands have been successful in disruption to the degree that they have. So that's great as a lovely, pretty theory, but let's make it real. So that is the same model, but it's actually expressed in numbers. And this is the household spend for each type of activity. So let's think about that at its most basic level. If someone's in cutlery, then they're sitting inside of that tableware aspect within dining at home. So they think they're competing for about $8 per year per household on average for cutlery spend. But actually, they're also part of this bigger element around dining at home. How much of that could they eat? And actually, they're inside of an entire system where there's $14,000 on average across the home for all of the full context of food consumption. How much of that can I eat? This is the biggest question that's starting to emerge from everyone who's getting into this system thinking. So we're going to have a look at that grocery and the knock-on effects it's having. We'll have a look at consumer food service, and we'll have a look at food preparation. We'll deep dive. The stories in all of this, but those are the ones where I think the system and the implications of the system become clearest. So I'm going to jump into grocery to start with. This is going to cover a number of topics, but the one I want you to take away is the dilemma that's happening on protein and what implications that's having. How are people changing behavior because of what's happened to protein? That's the biggest part of this. So if we start off with the overall thing, don't worry, I'm not going to try and explain this whole thing. There's a wealth of data to go and drown in inside of this. There can be a copy of this, no problem. There's a QR code at the end, so you can peruse this to your heart's desire at your leisure later on. Every one of these has got stories, but the ones I want to focus on is starting off with food kits and what's going on in that space. We're also going to touch on the plant-based dairy and break out what's happening there. That's actually hidden inside of the dairy products and alternatives, but I'm breaking it out because it's got such a better profile for demand versus overall dairy, and there's a story inside of that. And also we've got fresh food, and that's where the protein story is sitting, and I'm going to dive into that. So if we think about these kits to start with, yes, we've got the quick recipe kits. This is more like the hamburger type products and also the tacos and El Paso. There's a number of products inside of it, but you'll notice that's not breaking the world. There's nothing about that that's changing everything. Yes, it's had growth, but it's not kept up with inflation. If we look as well at these chilled lunch things, that's the Lunchables type product. And yes, it's got recent growth. It's falling inside of the commuting, the hybrid, the back to work. So the on-the-go consumption has benefited this, but it's not, again, the enormous growth rates. Where it's really sitting is inside these meal kits. And when we dig a little bit deeper, I mean, think 160% growth, and that's really more than doubling in size. And within that, that's all about HelloFresh. And HelloFresh, when we go into their numbers, they're talking about times four in growth in that same time period. So when we look at it, they view North America as one of their big growth engines. So a little bit about HelloFresh. We've analyzed their main meals, the best sellers that they've got. There's a couple of things that jump out. That is far too big a mix of no meat for the gen population. I mean, what we're looking at here is the millennial profile. It's almost exactly the same mix as we have for millennials for vegan and vegetarian diet choices. What we also see is this pan-fried with dairy at some point in the recipe, and it's either being added to the meat or it's being added to the actual veg and fiber. But whichever way it is, if it's not non-stick, we've got ourselves a problem. So there's a cleaning element and there's a problem element around cookware particularly attached to this, and there is a non-stick message I'll come back to that in a minute. What we also have is this instruction around cooking for the carbs and the fiber. Microwaves has got a growing role inside of that, but what we noticed was roasted and pan-fried is the instruction, but that's not what people are actually doing. And what's changed is this rise of people replacing both of those functions with air frying. And the initial reaction from the brand was to start thinking, okay, well, here's a bunch of air frying recipes to make better use out of this equipment and lean into the trend. But what we actually then saw, which was a much better reaction, was a retroactive, let's go back across the entire recipes and put in place settings and guidance to how to air fry to get to the same sort of outcome. And that was appreciated much more strongly by the consumer base. There's the active listening, they've gained advocacy, there's all kinds of things that have come. What we have noticed, though, is the last 9 months or so, that narrative has changed. And what's happening is people have gone from, aren't air fryers wonderful, to, do I really need an oven anymore? And we're into questions around possession. We track possession rates for appliances, and my consumer appliance colleague is going to watch this one very closely, because effectively what we have potentially here is urbanization, pressure on space, and the first casualty of competition for space may well be actually on the radar already. So we look at the instructions and we look at what they're talking about in materials. Yes, they're covering the fact that you use three parts of the hob. We're into use of quite a lot of equipment, but it's all very generic. Yes, they talk about nonstick, but there's no messaging around what type of nonstick. What's the difference between nonstick and stick resistant? What's the difference between copper, steel? None of that. It's very, very basic, low level. It's simple cooking. They're trying to actively stay away from complicating this. One of the other things that jumps out is when you look at the utensils, they talk about these 13 kitchen essentials, but just looking at the 10 top selling recipes, why hit over 20 without even trying? So we've got things like zesters, which have actually made a difference to what's physically sitting inside of homes. That wasn't as prolific as it had been up until their growth, up until they started doing well. But there's a number of things that jump out. We've got a kitchen knife, but we've got to cut bread, we've got to cut fish, we've got to cut vegetables, we've got we've got no mention of filleting, we've got no mention of any of the various types of equipment that would make this better. That's not an accident. They're trying to stay away from complexity when in the instructions they're bringing that complexity in. So there's a message here around there are parts of this we should interfere with and should educate and should actually help to bring some of the technology messages into play. In terms of collaboration, I would say that the collaboration that's happened so far has been about helping HelloFresh actually convert homewares and utility brands and actually help them get into our space. Not so much the other way around. There hasn't been the same reciprocal element in the relationship. And yet when we look at some of the other players like Home Chef, we see this leaflet, this is from Caraway, which is inside of the pack and actually making it into the home. That's then putting the same thing in reverse. It's an offer that's getting into the Home Chef shopping journey. So that's about the same sort of conversion. We can start to get the sort of health messages we want to. So there's this barrier to getting close to HelloFresh, fine. If it's not going to be endorsement, that would be the cleanest, nicest, lovely relationship, fine. It's not going to be that. What is association? Association is affinity, it's similarity, it's proximity. How do we make use of that to actually have an alignment to HelloFresh, to be in the same places, to be pushing your message, to actually benefit from how big a role they're playing in defining what healthy eating looks like right now? So one of the ways around this is, of course, they're in store and they're in quite a lot of stores that we're in already, but they also do one of the most prolific discount programs of any brand anywhere. And one of the places we want to disrupt and they want to disrupt is that loyalty switching moment around home buying and new homes. There are kits that estate agents, welcome kits, that get left in the home for new home buyers. why not be in the same kit? Being in the voucher booklet would be nice. Being on the next page right next to HelloFresh would be a whole different ballgame. So there's ways to actually manage affinity and association. We know that they just got in last month to a relationship with Cigna, and that's put their message in front of a large new audience. Why not also partner with their partner and be inside of the same space? But also one of the closest elements is causes and values. This is a worthy cause. I'm going to touch in a minute on food poverty and what's going on inside of some of the harshest choices that we've seen in a generation, two generations, inside of what's going on right now. They are supporting a cause. Their partner is supporting that cause. So hell of a way to break the ice and become buddies. So it's just a thought process. Affinity and association is an action, it's a choice. Be where they are, be next to them, be like them. This is one of the ways to actually solve this, even if they don't want an endorsement relationship to start with. So that's kits, which is really about how to make nice with HelloFresh. If we look then beyond that, we're into the plant-based dairy and what's going on inside of that. We have a really, really rapid, this is kind of exceptional. We haven't seen this level of change in 1 year for quite some time around veganism and vegetarian diet choices. And we have this data for across the world. I think we've pulled this for about 36 countries on the last cycle. So yes, we've got US, North America inside of this, but what we're seeing is two things jump out. One of them is millennials and that sudden rise in vegan choices, while vegetarian choice starts to tail off. And some of that is people exiting vegetarian to become flexitarian, health choices. Am I getting all the things from my diet that I need? Some of that is that, but actually most of it is going hardcore and heading into vegan in a bigger way and converting. And there's actually quite a big social media driven to an extent, but there's a heavy movement here. And what we see, if we look at the actual totals for the US, we have for the first time veganism exceeding vegetarian diet choices. That's got a few side effects. If we think about what's driving it, yes, a lot of the most recent element is around what's happening to milk and milk replacements within dairy, but we've also got cheeses, we've also got the yogurt. We've got some fairly hefty growth levels versus previous year across the pandemic. So what's actually the side effects? One of them is around clean and getting to clean. These substances subjected to heat have got a completely different viscosity to normal dairy. And there's a stickiness, there's a level of attachment that's not the same as we have with dairy. So a dishwasher is gonna have a struggle with this a little bit more than it does with dairy products. And we're already seeing some issues creeping up in terms of failure rates within machines, within detergent, not able to cope. And to think about how long the detergent guys have had to get good at doing dairy, it took them decades. Now they've got to get started on plant-based ingredients and get good at actually finding enzymes that can eat those, enzymes that are good at removing. There are something like 26 different types of enzyme that are great at doing egg. How long is it going to take us to figure out the ones that are great at doing like the plant-based ingredients? So one of the other things is, of course, vegan diets are attached to a number of ingredients and sources which are fantastic at destroying food containers faster than most of our diets. Turmeric is the one that's actually most closely associated. It even beats tomato to pole position in terms of how quickly this can do damage. The good news about that is it actually plays to one of our spaces within food storage. Glass, and particularly Triton, has a fantastic value story inside of that for vegan households. And by the way, millennial vegan households are shooting up in number. We've got a fairly clean target audience to go after with the Triton story. So there are some upsides to this. If we think about fresh food, so this percentage of price increase tells part of the story. I'm gonna take a wee drink. So this is the protein picture for fresh. And if we look at it, we've boiled it down to price per kilo to give the beginnings of this story. But this is only part of it, because of course different types of food contain different levels of protein. So then we need to weight it. And once we've weighted it for protein, there we go. So meat, of course, has the highest protein content out of all of the food materials. Eggs, we put it into context. Eggs has had a very strong price movement. This is related to the bird flu. It's related to the general disruption that's affected so many aspects of food. But just look at what we see as a picture. This helps explain the pattern of demand. Meat has become the cheapest form of protein. Eggs was the cheapest form of protein, but has now become still one of the best forms of protein, but not quite as good. And look at fish. Fish has actually, and seafood, has become, it was always a premium form of protein, but that gap has just gone up enormously. So if people are making choices in their budget for how to still actually manage protein, we've got a fairly hefty change in what they're actually going to prioritize. And when we then look at this picture, some of the bits jump out as obvious. So eggs, I've helped by putting in, rather than just think about value, because of course eggs had a much higher level of inflation than the other areas, I've put in where it was actually a volume increase rather than just a value increase. And we can see eggs, meat, having a particularly good time. We can see seafood going off a cliff. And this is the dietary choices that we can see. What's done best, what's had the best demand profile? Eggs. And if we think about that within the fresh plate, eggs is currently up to about 12% of fresh protein. And that's constrained. That was in the midst of a bird flu crisis. It's getting better. We haven't seen that peak yet. How much of our protein is actually going to be coming from this route? And one of the things we track is also Google Trends, and you can see that cheapest protein, it's still trending up. This is going into 2024, this is becoming something people are more and more looking into. And when we get to their findings, what's healthy protein? Where's cheap protein? Eggs is popping up an awful lot. You can find some normal egg stories. You can also find, there's an interesting guy who's creating those interesting spikes with social media, and he's talking about egg fried rice. And so there's disruption inside of here. It's not perfect. Uncle Roger, I think his name is, he's had some interesting stories. So eggs is still a major part of this story. And when we look at how that affects us, it's getting back to this air frying, getting back to the microwave. This has become the hybrid working breakfast of choice. Why? Because it's fast, it's healthy. Lots of people are out there telling us how healthy it is. Some of the rules around whether eggs were healthy changed in 2022, very helpfully to tie up with this. And so that's it. This is the tailwind. This is what's driving our opportunity, is if we're into accessories, if we're into eggs and supporting egg production, this is actually one of the biggest tailwinds in the sector. And checking with the food team, eggs for the forecast for next year and looking out to 2027 has one of their most attractive profiles. So that in a nutshell is grocery and what actually helps and matters within grocery and how it's actually influencing home behavior. I'm going to pass you over to Catalina, who can talk about consumer food service. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick. My name is Catalina, and I'll be talking about consumer food service, so restaurants, and its effects in home cooking. So basically, the consumer food service industry has had great value growth since 2021. This value growth has sustained through last year, and we're projecting that this year there will be important value growth too. But a lot of it is tied to price increases and inflation. So if we look at transactions, which is basically the volume of consumer food service, we see that that is up too. And this is really important because that means that consumers are not cooking as much. And something important is that maybe they're not eating all of their meals at restaurants. Why? Because consumers, and we see this in one of the trends, consumers are searching for value. They're searching for, maybe some are trading down to more affordable alternatives, but others are getting a lot of takeout, delivery, and eating those meals at home. And looking at this chart, we see where consumers are, how our consumers are getting their food and probably where they are eating them. And in this sense, we see a lot of success in the long term for online takeout and delivery, which is tied to apps and websites, etc. However, we see eating continues to be big, but in the long term, we see more success for takeout and delivery. And all of this has an impact in home cooking because consumers are trying to, since they're eating these meals at home, we see a tendency for trying to replicate the restaurant experience in the home. And with this strong growth of eating in restaurants, we also get the results from our consumer lifestyle survey, where we see that from 2019 to 2024, we see a 4% increase in total consumers eating out either several times a week or every day. But this same data, looking at it from the standpoint of millennials, we see a 26-point increase in consumers eating out. This is something that's never been seen before. Millennials are eating out a lot. And this is because of what the information they're consuming, social media, their focus towards self-care and socializing. So the millennials are definitely a generation to keep an eye on. And the growth of consumer food service and consumers eating out has negative and positive implications for cookware and bakeware. I'm going to only name a few negative, but then we'll focus in the positive. Some of the negative implications are a possible decreased demand for new products and delay replacement cycles as consumers are not cooking as much. And also we see some threats to food storage as some consumers are reusing their leftover boxes, their takeout boxes, and using those in their day-to-day. Similarly happens with cutlery. A lot of consumers get takeout, get delivery, and use those utensils. Now, in terms of the positive implications, we see that experiencing a diverse amount of culinary experiences, restaurants, types of food, is leading to a fueled desire to recreate those meals at home, which can drive the demand for specialized cookware. And we're forecasting that stovetop cookware is going to be over $3 billion in 2028 without inflation. So with inflation, that number will be higher. And with bakeware, we're expecting $1 billion in sales in the U.S. So there is space, therefore, growth for new players and for current players. In addition, we're starting to see a growing trend around bringing your own container to restaurants. I put here an article from a month ago that is trying to impulse this trend. And we've seen a little bit of coffee shops telling their consumers to bring their own mugs to get their coffee. So this trend is not very strong yet, but there's something to keep an eye on. And we see innovation like the one we see here from Stojo of around collapsible food storage. It's easy. You can bring it flat in your bag and then make it deeper once you put your food on it. And this is important because we see a strong competition around the kitchen for space. And items like Stojo's food storage can really fight and win that fight for storage, as you can store more in less space. Another of the positive implications is increased demand for high-quality cookware. Because consumers are more informed and have so many influences from high-quality restaurants, from social media, we see a push for higher-quality cookware. And now, I mentioned a little bit about the importance of social media, but we have seen a true increase in usage of TikTok. If you were here in the previous session, it was mentioned as well. TikTok has a lot of influences in terms of food, as you can take two sides. It either shows you restaurant reviews, which drives traffic at restaurants, or it shows you home cooks making meals at home, showing tutorials. So all of those things continue to inspire people to maybe cook more and to replicate the restaurant at home. And now let's look a little bit about what's happening inside of the kitchen. How are consumers making their food, and are they even making food at home? And the results of our lifestyle survey shows that everyday cooking is declining. We see a 5% decline since 2019, before the pandemic, in almost everyday cooking. And all of this growth went to one or two times a week cooking. So consumers, it's not that they're not eating, but they're eating out or they're eating leftovers. So that opens opportunities within cookware as well. But why are consumers not cooking? We've gotten a lot of answers in our lifestyle survey throughout the years, and they're all around, I don't cook well, I don't like to cook, I don't have time. But this year we saw a different answer rise above everything else, which was consumers rather spend their time doing other things. Priorities just shifted. So we have to find a way, and this is special for younger generations, so we have to find a way to engage with those consumers whose priorities have shifted. And how are consumers spending their money around food? We see a lot of success in the small cooking appliance world, so air fryers, rice cooker, bread makers. They're all healthier, multifunctional, save time, etc. And we see some struggles within stovetop cookware and ovenware, but that's because of the great success they had during the pandemic. In terms of, consumers are looking for appliances with additional health benefits, speed, versatility, ease of use, and they're looking to replicate the restaurant experience at home. And air fryers, we've mentioned them several times, they're a great example of this. And if we look at air fryer performance in the U.S. in the past few years and in the forecast period, we see 3 years of really strong double-digit growth. And even 2023, when everything struggled in the market, air fryers did pretty well. They had over 9% growth. And we're expecting in the forecast period for the growth to sustain. And that growth in the forecast period doesn't have inflation, so numbers will be higher. And in terms of Google Trends, we see air fryer recipes growing since 2019, and it's sustaining. And it's cyclical. It has some seasonality. But that means that consumers are buying air fryers, but then they're using it, they're adapting them to their needs, which is very important when getting a new product. In terms of speed, bread makers are amazing. You don't have to spend 3 days making sourdough. You can just do 15 minutes of work, and then the bread will be ready for you in a little bit. And in terms of versatility, we've seen great examples here at the show with Greenpan's 9-in-1 air fry oven and also KitchenAid. Their stand mixers now have attachments, which you can also make pasta or use it as food processor, which is great and speaks a little bit around that system thinking that Nick was mentioning. And in terms of replicating the restaurant experience at home, we are looking at three different directions, or kind of one and a half. One is around large and small cooking appliances, and the other one is around how you replicate the experience at home in terms of tableware, dinnerware, glassware, etc. And this is all because our lifestyle survey is also showing us that consumers are hanging out with their friends at least weekly before more than pre-pandemic numbers. So 36% of consumers are hanging out with their friends at least weekly, which really opens up the opportunities around hosting. In this sense, there are big opportunities for recreating the restaurant experience at home. This is a way of experiencing food beyond the restaurant. You're almost elevating your lifestyle. There used to be a conception of formal diningware versus daily diningware, but now everything is just one. Consumers have a lot of consumers, especially younger generations, have a high sense of aesthetics, and they have a vision, and they will go for it. And it's not only for higher priced products or textiles, it's whatever fits their aesthetic. And now looking at large appliances, we see Miele making this dialogue oven, which is a very premium product in which you can cook ice, a fish in ice, and put it in the oven, and the ice won't melt. You can make steak in beeswax. It's fully smart. The technology is called M-Chef, so it's really bringing that Michelin star experience to your home, but it's very premium still. And finally, my favorite small appliance so far, I don't know if you're familiar with it, is Thermomix. This is a small appliance that's highly popular in Latin America and Europe. It's sold direct to consumer, but it's really making its way into the U.S. And you don't have to cook. It solves all the problems. You don't have to cook. You don't have to. The appliance cuts for you, cooks, kneads. It even self-cleans. So it's really, it has so many opportunities, and I think it's just a matter of time for it to really pick up in popularity in the U.S., and they already opened their first store in Miami not long ago. So basically, and they also sell a bunch of other products, also falling into this system thinking. And so consumers are having more and more solutions to the issues they have around cooking. So the opportunities are wide for us. We just have to know what's our space, what's our place, and how to dive into that.
Super. Thank you, Catalina. Righty. I'm going to wrap up, but first of all, I'm going to explain the Miele dialogue oven and the cooking of fish inside of the ice. It's got directed phases. Think of it as the Starship Enterprise, and it can, without melting the ice, get the fish up to full temperature and cook it without touching the eye. I mean, it's really clever. And what was special about it is they've actually gone into actually doing the food service themselves. So an appliance company is now actually selling and sending the food to be made by the user, but they're using it with this fancy oven so they can pretend to be one of the top level Michelin chefs without having to actually learn anything. So that's what this system causes people to change in their thinking, is how much of this. They had the spend, they had the bite out of their cake inside of the appliances, now they're taking a bite out of consumer food service. What next? So that's what this system thinking does, and that's what it changes. So thinking ahead, what does 2024 look like? We can listen to lots of voices around the direction it's going to go. They range from disaster to it's okay, we'll be fine. There's a lot of variation in this space, but effectively one of the consistent thoughts is the best we can hope for in 24 is stability, with optimism sitting somewhere further out. 25 is the earliest place to get excited about numbers. Some of the recommendations are 26. So if we actually think about some of the dynamics behind all of that, we can see the mortgage rate interest and we can see the forecast for that as we go forward. But look, that's the recovery. And the recovery gets us back kind of to here. So that's what the optimistic view is. It gets us back to where we were on the big decline into transactions falling away, demand falling away. So just keep in mind stability with some optimism creeping in back end of 24, and then we see an uplift starting 25. If we then think about propensity and what people are saying they're going to do, naturally there's a huge gap between what people say they're going to do and then what they actually do. But this was in the field literally 6 weeks ago, and we can see a couple of things jumping out. One, there's some revenge restauranting going on inside of the intent to get out and go and experience things a bit more from the younger generation. What we can also see is the grocery and the knowledge that grocery and food is going to be a problem in the budget, and there's more of that to come. That's an expectation that's across the board. And we can also see within the older generations, that's then leading to a knowledge they want to pull back on normal home spending. And given how much we're dependent on some of the older age bands for spend, that's not great news. That's one of the things that's driving 2024 numbers. So if we think about it, that is the future, and it's a slightly different structure, so I'll do my little stint again. long-term growth on the left-hand side, short-term growth on the base, and if we add inflation, everything moves sideways about 3 points by the current forecasts. But keep in mind, this is looking at actual growth in spend for each type of activity per household. So you can see how much the forecast is far more optimistic for the consumption of food outside of the home, and how much of that's relating to food prep does recover after a really harsh 24, but dining at home's got the additional problem of saturation. And until we get past the saturation from the boom of 2020-21 and we get into normal replacement cycles, we're still looking at a fairly dark situation. Naturally, innovation can interfere with that and can change that profile, but that's how it's currently shaped up to view from industry statistics, from macroeconomics that are driving this. So let's think about that system for a moment. We've seen one movement already of an appliance brand getting into food storage. It was vacuum technology that brought them across. And so they've got vacuum technology in their fridge, they've put food prep products with vacuum, and then they started making their own food containers. What's next? Haier inside of some of these other systems are now actually making their own toilets, they're making their own beds, they're doing all, there are no limits the moment these guys start testing, what can I do? And they are starting to test in our space what they can do. So expect more expansion inside of that. And one last parting thought. So there's been quite a lot of conversation around sizes and space and what's happening in kitchens. And we've got this data. This is SKU tracking around the message that is being promoted on product. So does this necessarily mean something new has appeared on SKUs? Not necessarily. It could be that we're just talking about features in a way that we didn't before. And one of the things I can see is if we look at ovenware, what I can see ramping up, ovenware mentioning storage. So smaller storage, small footprint, what can I fit inside of? We're talking about dimensions more. But the biggest thing that I can see happening is the rise of stackable, and that's just accelerating. And we've also got this creeping nested message coming in from the base. When I think about cookware, yes, we've got storage as a story, but the one that's very, very gradually creeping up is detachable. And then we're into handles, and we're into how can we change the physical dimensions this thing can fit into. So that idea of competition for space, if anyone's wondering, is this going away? Is it plateau? No. I do furniture as well, and I can see integrated storage in furniture is also ramping up. So there's a lot more of this to come in pipelines. This trend is not done. So that's everything in terms of prepared material. I think we've got maybe a minute and a half for questions. Sorry, Mike.
Switch on these things, difficult. Does anyone have any questions? I want to ask about something, and I'm very curious because you're the person who actually can answer this question. There are a few people who can.
Bit scared now, but fine.
Well, it's what's interesting to me is we were talking about eggs and the cost of eggs, okay? For a long time, we knew there's different qualities of meat and there's different amounts of money you pay for them, so you can move up and down in that. We've also seen this in organic produce. You have in supermarkets a dozen eggs for $1.29 and a dozen eggs for $3.99, mm-hmm. And that's conventional, and that's free range. How does that affect, you know, how you look at the market? Because, it's funny, at the same time you had eggs as a more expensive protein, but you still had a lot of popularity. Mm-hmm. Does this kind of, and you're seeing this in different food categories, these kinds of differentiations, have an effect on how we should think about cookware. So in other words, don't just think about the price, think about also what the actual performance is, because people mm-hmm. have choices within those areas.
I would say everything's relative. So just because eggs has gone up in price, just because there's a shortage of some of the cheaper forms of egg, because of course a disease is going to go through the population of the smaller living standards that the cheaper chickens are actually sitting inside of. So it'll impact that more, and that's part of what we've seen inside of the rise in the average price. But keep in mind, yes, eggs have gone up in price, but it's relative to what else. And if you're getting more hit inside of your budget, where are you going to save money? It isn't on your $2, $3, $5 element. You'll think more about whether or not, how many steaks can I afford to buy on this shop? You're talking $15 a pop in some of those. That's where the decision creeps in. Far more than on something. I think in some elements we're heading into grocery, and some parts of grocery is a considered purchase. And it's there's a lot less impulse going on. We're heading into budgets where I can't physically afford to buy the range of product I used to, and that's what we're seeing reflected inside of here. I don't think eggs is particularly being hurt, not at all inside of this choice. It's fish and seafood in all of its various forms. We've got frozen, we've got chilled, we've got all, this is the one that's taken the big hit. People have actually run away from it as a form of protein because it's just too expensive versus their current budgets.
Anybody else have any questions? I'm going to ask another question just because it was in the end of the presentation, it was interesting. Food storage. There's tons of stuff going on in food storage. Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, cook to store, collapsible, everything else. You talked about furniture, mm-hmm. organizations, but that's been a big deal, and people have been innovating in that area. Do you expect that to remain one of the stronger areas, at least through 2024, where people are looking, are going to look and going to purchase more food storage solutions? And as you noted, there are companies that are asking, you know, cafes or coffee companies, asking you to bring your own mug. I mean, do you think that's an important trend to watch?
Trend to watch, and 2024 will be a tough year for the industry overall, but one of the few categories that it's actually going to grow is food storage. It is growing immensely, and another category that it's going to continue to grow, we didn't talk about it, but it's reusable water bottles, drinks and mugs and tumblers and all of those things. So definitely, and in the home, in terms of furniture, food storage will also continue to grow because we've seen that the housing market has been hurt a little bit, so people can't move, so they're trying to figure out their living situation with the limited amount of space that they have. So everything storage, growing forever. Now, in the short term.
And this does seem to be some innovation.
Just adding to that a little bit, so if you go back to the chart around cooking every day, some of that drop-off is leftovers and heading more into leftovers. One of the things people do to save money is actually more bulk cooking. So this dynamic, this economy, is, if anything, going to increase the need for food storage. And we're already talking about clutter. We're already talking about how much we've got problems fitting what we have now. So, yeah, and I've got the data around SKU tracking for food storage as well, and I can see some of the stories around storage are ramping up inside of that as well. So it's an ongoing problem.
We had a conversation with that in another session, and what was interesting is not only in terms of saving money, but also what's interesting to me is leftovers were once bad. Now you save money and it's a more sustainable way to eat. So now now leftovers are virtuous.
And we now have air fryers in so many homes who can make them like new again. That's one of the stories which is doing particularly well. So the reconstitution back to high quality is part of what this air fryer, this story's got a lot of legs.
Well, thank you very much. That was very interesting. If nobody else has any questions, thank you for coming. And we'll see you again hopefully next year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.